Welcome back to the Dear Katie podcast. This is Katie Kestner, and I am so pleased today that we are rejoining with Isaac. And Isaac had shared his story and journey with us on a prior episode, but we decided there was so much more to be discussed around his own, you know, healing journey and where he is and navigating triggers and trust and all kinds of fabulous topics. So just as a reminder to our listeners, the content we cover in our podcast can be very challenging. Feel free to step aside, push pause, come back at any time. Self-care is so very important to all of us. So with that said, welcome back, Isaac. So anyone who missed you first time around, could you kindly just give us a little snapshot of who you are and what brings you to your microphone?
Yeah, most definitely. Thank you so much for having me back. I'm super excited and I had a wonderful time talking with you the last time. So yeah, my name is Isaac Andrade and I'm 27 years old and I currently live in Indianapolis, Indiana. What brings me to a microphone is just sharing my story. When I was around 14 years old, between my freshman and sophomore year, I experienced an isolated event of sexual assault at a college campus at a house party. And so I'm just here sharing my story and hopefully it helps someone.
Thank you so much, Isaac. And, you know, I encourage our listeners, if you missed Isaac's personal story, please do revisit it. It's so important. We're so fortunate. Isaac identifies as gay, I believe. Would that be accurate? Or would you want to use non-binary? Or how would you like to phrase it?
Yeah, nope. I'm a gay cis man.
And you also are from the Midwest. And you are a person of color, true?
Yes, I am biracial, both black and
Yeah. So I think we're so excited to have as many diverse voices and experiences on the podcast as we possibly can. And we are truly honored to bring you back to part two. So, you know, I'll start out this way, Isaac, to get you thinking. But I think for all of us who go through sexual violence of any form, there is the initial trauma, the almost like blocking it out and thinking, how could this have really happened? Kind of that shock and denial phase. So I'd like to talk about that. But then as we start unpacking those pieces of harm and hurt, you know, sometimes they come back when we smell something again, or when we hear the song that was playing at the time, or when we see someone who looks like a perpetrator in a crowded space, all of a sudden it's like panic, or we feel afraid because we're trapped in a room without a door nearby. Maybe let's start out with that kind of shock and denial phase, and then we can move into kind of unpacking those trigger pieces.
Yeah, most definitely. Immediately after the assault took place, I think I mentioned this on the last episode, I told myself and made the decision that I wasn't going to tell anyone else. And there's a bunch of different reasons for that. And we kind of dived into that last time. But I stuck true to that. When I got home, my father realized that I had left without permission and it took the car. And so I was grounded. And so trying to forget what happened, I actually had alcohol delivered to my window every night by a friend that lived in the neighborhood, and I just drank myself to sleep, kind of self-soothing, just trying to forget because I had a lot of time alone with myself, and I thought the only way I could kind of get through that moment was if I forgot. And so for about 2 weeks, that was the routine. I drank myself until I went to sleep and woke up and started again. And that was, I mean, while it's not a very productive coping mechanism, it certainly did the job because I had pretty much repressed what I had felt and what I had gone through. And so I was fully in denial, almost as if it didn't happen to me. It was something that I had watched on TV or, you know, read in a book or something. It wasn't something that was a part of me. And so that I felt like was my first really dive into the denial piece of it, just completely denying that it had happened to me.
You know, I think it's so interesting, Isaac, that you just, it was so instinctive just to numb it out and push it away, and you found a coping mechanism, whether healthy or not, that did the job, as you said. And I think that so many of us subconsciously are just looking for some quick fix or some way to black it out. Myself, my initial reaction was like, I don't ever want to go in my dorm room again. How practical could that be? So I ended up some nights like sleeping in unsafe areas. I can remember I slept on the sofa in the lounge area of the dorm, like instead of going back to go where it was. So I think, you know, that insight is really helpful. And then, you know, then this wore off, you said about 2 weeks or longer?
I self-soothed for about 2 weeks. And then there was a whole 2 year period where I just went on business as normal. And looking back at it now, I can definitely see when I was triggered by certain things, how I kind of compensated for what had happened. I actually, in our trauma work, we call them masks that we put on to kind of hide a piece of ourselves. And I definitely did that. I jumped into academics and I hit the ground running. I went from being a B minus student to having an A plus in almost all of my classes. And I started doing theater and I started to be more social. And I really overcompensated for that part of me to the point where, you know, after that two year period, I was exhausted. I didn't want to be alone in my thoughts. And so I just tried to add as much as I could to my plate in order to kind of, I don't know, just kind of distract myself, I guess.
That makes a lot of sense, Isaac. It really does. Like, not having any downtime is another way to, you know, push away the nightmares and the trauma. So interesting. Go ahead.
No, yeah. And then kind of speaking to the point of what kind of triggered me, I would say probably the most prevalent and salient trigger at that moment was just my complete and utter distrust for men of any kind. There were some people in my life earlier on that I kind of grandfathered into being able to trust, but anyone new I met, I was very hesitant to put my trust, or I was very guarded. And looking back at the time, I didn't know why I was doing that. I wasn't aware what had changed or that had changed in general, but that was something that really precipitated kind of what happened next. And that was, you know, I had a physical altercation with my father, and this was about 2 years after the assault had taken place. And at that moment, everything came rushing back. It was being held down by a man stronger than myself to, like, really remind myself. My body remembered exactly what I felt back then. And I immediately went numb and the floodgates opened. And in that moment, I was like, I can't handle this anymore. I don't think I can survive right now. And so it was, you know, having that and some of the things that my father had said to me that really just brought up a lot of what I had felt when I was experiencing that trauma. And so I called my mom and I said, hey, here's the deal. I need to go somewhere or I don't think I'm going to make it past the night. And she, being a nurse, she knows to take these things seriously. And we went to the behavioral care unit at our local hospital. And that was when I had my first opportunity to just come clean and say everything that I had felt. And it was probably, you know, I don't think it was the trauma or what had happened that really got me to that point. I think my first words to the triage nurse was that I was just so tired. And I asked her, do you know what it feels like to have to hide such a big part of yourself? And how tired I was by putting my everything into school and extracurriculars and my friends and my, you know, social engagements and whatnot. I was just tired. I felt like I had ran myself into the ground. And that was what made me feel like I couldn't go on anymore because there was no way I could hide it.
And just two questions that come to mind for our audience. First, the behavioral hair unit, and then your age. Like, so now are you 16 or 17 at this point?
Yeah, I'd be 16 at this point.
I was just, you know, overwhelmed with how brilliant and advanced and, you know, how much wherewithal you've had to think so thoughtfully and through this such a young age. So, you know, it's hard when trauma happens so young, but it sounds like you were able to articulate really well what you needed and, or at least what you were feeling. And the behavioral care unit in a hospital, I bet a lot of people don't really know what that means or how to access it because we all hear about the ER. What can you tell us more about what the behavioral unit was? Is that a place where you can go and stay overnight? Or is it, yeah.
It's kind of like an offshoot of the ER that I was brought to. And it's specifically for people experiencing mental health challenges. So whether that be suicidal or homicidal ideations, something that made someone unsafe either to themselves or to the community. as far as their mental health status. And so the idea of it was, you know, going in, meeting with someone to see if I needed to be admitted or not. And of course, this was because I was 16, I would go into the adolescent portion of the behavioral care unit. And I actually had a friend previously who had an extended stay at the same unit. And I think that's what kind of gave me the skills. I kind of had the knowledge that something was out there feeling that way. On top of the fact that, you know, my mom was a nurse and I've been around healthcare all my life. And so lucky enough and privileged enough to have a support system that is not wary of the healthcare field. And so the only option they felt they had was to take me to this place and see if they could admit me, because at least they know that I would be supervised and I would be getting the help that I needed in order to overcome this acute feeling of hopelessness and worthlessness. And so you have to meet with the triage nurse, and the triage nurse kind of hears what you have to say and sees what you're feeling. And then they bring it up to a healthcare team. And then they decide to admit you for how long, or if at that moment it wasn't, you know, such a severe case that they could turn me away. And I told the triage nurse and I immediately was admitted. And I was there, I think, kind of receiving treatment, getting on some meds and going through like group treatment, I guess.
Yeah, was the therapy geared towards sexual abuse and assault survivors, or just mental health in general?
No, I was the only one there that I know of that was there for something like this.
Yeah, who was in the group? Like, what kinds of folks? And was it all male?
No, it was mixed. And the majority of the people that were there were suicide risks. And a handful of people that had some behavioral issues that caused the community to feel unsafe. It felt kind of like a timeout from life a little bit, and that the only thing that you could focus on was getting better and trying to figure out what the right combination of meds and treatment and just kind of overall rehabilitation, I guess, to go back into society and receive treatment outside of the hospital.
So overall, how long were you there and what did you take away from it?
I think I was there the first time for about a week and a half, and that was a pretty long time, enough to see people come and go. I think the standard stay was probably about 4 or 5 days. And through that time, they were kind of calibrating, you know, what my dosage of medication would be. And, you know, there's a lot of trial and error, and you have to answer the questionnaires just right in order for them to want to release you. And through that time, they're working with your family and the people that would be taking care of you outside of the hospital to enroll me in some outpatient care. And through that, the hospital actually gave my parents a resource for specifically sexual assault advocacy, where I could go free of charge and kind of work through the trauma side of it, and then also go to an outpatient therapy to work on the mental part of it. And hopefully it would all blend together and help me become rehabilitated.
So as you navigated all of these courses of therapy and healing, give us some highlights, you know, that might help others either know what really helped you or what really didn't help you.
So I have kind of two conflicting stories that were kind of the biggest takeaways from my time there initially, because this was the first time I had told anyone. And of course, the triage nurse briefed everyone on the unit, the care team on the unit, what had happened to me, and they all knew. I hadn't told them myself, but it was in my chart, obviously. And the first thing, which wasn't so great, I overheard one of the behavioral technicians, someone who leads kind of our group and therapy and activities and whatnot, talking to some of the other nurses. And he was talking about me. And I remember him saying, "He's a big guy. How could he let someone do that to him?"
Oh, no.
And that was the first time I really experienced kind of the pressure and the hardship that survivors must go through on a daily basis. Because this is fresh, like this is the first time anyone has ever heard that this had happened to me. And that's one of the first things that I heard. And that kind of sent me down a spiral. And it kind of gave me an idea of just how guarded I would have to be going through it, knowing that there were people who just wouldn't understand initially. But on the flip side of that, I remember having a conversation with one of the nurses who kind of helped get me checked in and helped me navigate kind of where I'd be sleeping and did all of my assessments and whatnot. And I couldn't sleep one night and I went out and I'm like, can I talk to you? And that was the first time I sat down and actually told someone on like my own accord or what had happened to me and why I felt like I did and why I didn't want to live anymore. And she then comforted me and, you know, told me too. And I kind of asked how she lived with it, and she gave me some wonderful advice. And that was the first time I had felt what it was like to interact with another survivor, now knowing what my status was. And that completely changed the course of how I was going to get better.
Do you remember anything she said at that moment that was helpful for advice?
Yeah, it was, you know, it was all pretty standard, you know, the kind of stuff that we hear all the time. Yeah, it's not your fault. You're not alone. Take it one day at a time. It does not define you. She also mentioned, you know, there's going to be people in your life that are going to be harder to tell than others, and kind of just, you know, say like, it shouldn't feel like a secret to you. It should feel like something that you can tell people that you trust, and that ultimately, if you believe in your support system, they'll help you through it. But that was the first time I was hearing that. You know, that was my first time being introduced to the language of survivorship that we hear now. And that's what got me through it. You know, that's what helped me sleep. And that's what helped me decide that this was something that I could tackle and I could overcome.
So at this stage, you're still in high school, but you're starting to navigate through what this means in your life. Do I have the timeline right? So then what happens next for you? And ultimately, I want to head toward any really tough periods or things that you've been through and how you went through those. And then where are you going next with your life and how it kind of impacted any choices? Because it's, you know, obviously it's happening so young in your life and now it probably has a lasting lifelong impact. But so you're in high school, you do graduate.
Yeah. And actually I was still in high school, and I got a referral to an organization here that provides one-on-one sexual assault advocacy. And so I was able to do that once a week. And that's what really got me through and gave me the tools to cope with what had happened. I would say the kind of the abridged version, kind of hitting on all of your points, the hardest thing that happened after going to the behavioral unit was when I went to this organization, they had to report what had happened. And I hadn't previously thought that I ever wanted to pursue any kind of legal or law enforcement action because I was a minor, and because it happened on a college campus, they had to report it. And she was talking me through it. She's like, this is just what happens. And I can give them all the information and they can decide if they want to interview you or not and just let it be. And unfortunately for me, because it wasn't kind of the road I wanted to go down, we were contacted by a detective and asked to come in, and I was interviewed. And that was probably one of the hardest things I had to go through after the fact, because he was plenty nice. He was a very nice man, but the questions they were asking were, it felt like it was beside the point. And I had this conflicting motive that I didn't want my friends to know, and I didn't want to pursue any legal action. And so
why do you think that was, you know, Isaac? What was keeping you from that? Was it it would take too long? You thought you couldn't win? Like, what were some of the factors that, because you seem so strong. So this part's interesting. So what were you thinking?
I knew that I wasn't going to really be able to offer anything. I didn't have the clothes that I was wearing when it happened. I had no idea who this person was, and I didn't even see their face. So I thought that it would just be more harm than good to kind of go down this rabbit hole, on top of the fact that I don't think I would have been strong enough at that time to be in treatment and to kind of dredge up a lot of these memories that I spent so long trying to repress. Knew, I don't think I had the wherewithal to go through the legal side of things. And I was told all the way through that it was my choice. And I think that just kind of, that's what motivated me. I was too busy focusing on myself. And I knew that, you know, if I walked in and said, this is what I know, I can give you the information that I have. I find it really hard to believe that anyone could really do anything for me. And so that was kind of the motivation.
So then what's next? So you set that aside. You're seeing the one-to-one counseling. I'm curious, did you have a preference for the gender of the counselor, or you didn't have a choice in the matter? Or it didn't really matter to you at all?
I don't think they had a man on staff. And even so, I think I would still have preferred a woman to help me through this.
That's interesting. What? Tell me, let's talk about that for a second. Why was that?
I was still very distrustful of men. And I think specifically being a gay man, there's a large divide in kind of how we perceive the world when it comes to sexual orientation. And I just felt like any man I talked to would judge me.
Even if he was gay?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, that's so interesting, Isaac.
It's very interesting. And I could talk on hours because it's kind of what I do now. Just talk about the intersection.
I want to definitely get to that part. In the next 10 minutes, I want to get through a little bit more of your healing. And then what you're doing now is just fabulous. And I can't wait to talk about that too.
Yeah, most definitely. So I went through this program and I was with them for about 2 years. So until I graduated high school, I was going to see this sexual assault advocate every week. And my mom even said, if you feel like he isn't ready, then we're not going to let him go to college. Because she saw how much progress I was making and how much it was helping. And so I stuck with it. And ultimately, it gave me the tools. But it was in one of those sessions where she was talking about how, you know, you create this trauma narrative and you weave it into your life and, you know, it becomes a part of you, but it's not what defines you. The next piece is to find meaning in that. And that was the hardest thing for me. And I think it's one of the hardest things for most people going through something like this, is how to make something positive out of something terrible that has happened. And through that, I realized, and she realized, because she really knew that I love to talk, that being part of their team of speakers and going around and talking to people and fundraising and whatnot was probably the best option for me. And so I was enrolled in that. And through that, I became connected with a whole bunch of wonderful people around the nation that allowed me to speak with them and came and interviewed me in college. And I was actually part of a documentary that has recently been released that's working its way through the festival circuit. And that none of that would have come about without being connected through this organization that helped me find meaning in what had happened to me. And so, I mean, that is exactly what got me on this podcast. I don't know if you or someone on your team reached out to Dr. David Lisak. Yes, but he was one of the first people that came in and interviewed me, and it was all very legit, but he wanted to create a network of male survivors and kind of just highlight their stories and let people around the world know that they're not alone. And through that, I've met so many wonderful people, so many wonderful survivors. And I think that is the single most important piece of my healing journey, is just being a part of this wonderful network.
I think that part is maybe where we land, because as having had a similar journey, but, you know, starting when I was 18 instead of 13, 14, I'm so proud of you, Isaac. And I think one thing that I get asked a lot is, it's almost like people think it's weird that we would want to be in a documentary or like the HBO movie, and it's still traumatic and it's not glamorous. It's not like, I would dare say neither of us are like, yes, it's so fabulous, I get to get my hair done and my nails. Like, that's not it. It's not like we're movie stars, but there's something so, to me, there's something so fabulous about taking the dark, terrible parts of our lives and putting them out there to be accessible, not in an egomaniac kind of way, but just like in a, like, let's talk about this and not hide it in the dark, as such a different motivation. And the other thing I thought we could talk about just in the last few minutes is kind of, what are your goals when you are speaking, and what kinds of things have you learned from doing that work? And then we can wrap up from there. Yeah, what do you love about it? What do you find helpful? What do people say to you? Because hopefully I'll be able to send you out and do some more speaking.
No, that would be awesome. I would love that. The reason I do it is because specifically, there are a lot of identities that are kind of glossed over when it comes to the narrative of assault in our country. And that's not to say that we really need to focus on the people that are disproportionately affected by the effects of sexual assault and abuse. But that's to say, you know, no one should feel alone in this journey. And me speaking as a man that identifies as gay, as Black, as someone that grew up in a rural setting, someone that religiously, you know, I have a very unique take on how my trauma has affected each part of those identities that I have. And I can speak to that. And maybe one person, you know, who grew up Mormon or who grew up in rural Iowa or something can take that piece and understand how it fits in with them. And so that is why I do it. And I also want to kind of bring a voice to men that are socialized to not speak up when things like this happen to them and that are forced to live with it in silence. That's a strong motivation for myself as well. And, you know, if I can reach anyone, then it's worth it.
I want to say, you know, I know we gave you double the time that we have for all of our guests, but it was so worth it to me, Isaac, to have you share this second half of your journey to bring us up to where you are now in your work to educate and bring awareness. And I very much hope that we can, you know, encourage more people to bring you out and have you at Take Back the Night events and, you know, share your story for awareness months and all kinds of ways. So I will be in touch shortly. But I wanted to, you know, make sure we were mindful of the time today so that, you know, anyone who wanted to power through both sessions wasn't glued to some sort of seat for too long. But I think you are so right when you say there's so many parts of you that are unique and also so important and relatable. So thank you, Isaac, for joining us again.
No problem. Thank you.
Yeah, and absolutely. And for all of our listeners on the Dear Katie podcast, again, please continue with self-care. Please learn from, you know, all the things Isaac shared about his healing journey. And it really sounds like one really powerful part was learning so much about himself and his own journey to be able to take that out and share it with other people in a healthy, positive way. So that's one important thing I took away today. And for our listeners, we hope you'll continue with that self-care. The TakeBackTheNight.org website has tons and tons of resources, lots of cool things to join in on that are free and global virtuals coming up. So please continue with your healing journey and we will see you again, talk to you again on another Dear Katie episode. Take care.